The Tom Woods Show, episode 1280.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, you'll never guess, I have yet another free ebook out. If you're like me, you stand up and cheer when professors resist the PC culture in universities. Well, I got a bunch of great stories for you in my new book, Think for Yourself, Professors Who Resisted the Mob Tell Their Stories. Grab your copy at againstthemob.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I thought today we would talk a bit about the Trump phenomenon and where it stands today, as well as the Democrats in the wake of the midterm elections. And joining us today is Dan McCarthy, who has a column in the New York Times out just the other day on this very question. Dan is editor-at-large of the American Conservative magazine, and he is currently editor of Modern Age, a conservative journal dating back to the 1950s. Check it out at modernagejournal.com. Dan, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. Delighted to be here.
Nice column in the New York Times. I don't know how you keep getting away with it, but you have that sophisticated air about you, and that allows you to get away with saying outrageous things. That's my theory anyway. So you're trying to assess the significance of the midterms here, and I realize that I'm kind of a day late on this, but just the way in the schedule that I do for recording the podcast, there was no way for me to get anything out any sooner. And then I saw your column, and I thought, all right, here we go. I'm going to rope McCarthy in to help me out talking about this. Everybody's got a theory as to whether the midterms represented a repudiation of Trump, a triumph of Trump, a purple wave, a purple ripple. What is your overall assessment of what it means?
Well, you know, I think the whole metaphor of a wave is inappropriate. And what we have here is instead a tide. The difference between a wave and a tide, of course, is that a tide is a regular phenomenon. It comes in and it goes out. And that's what we've seen with this midterm election, because each of the last four presidents, starting with Bill Clinton, then also with George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and now Donald Trump, we've seen the president lose control of the House of Representatives. And except for Bush, it happened to all of them during their first term. So this is now a sort of repeating phenomenon in American politics. And I don't think it speaks, you know, really to the particular strength or weakness of the presidents themselves that you see this phenomenon. Instead, it's the degree of the phenomenon. It's the size of the change that I think is most significant. And Donald Trump lost fewer seats in the House this year than Bill Clinton had lost in 1994, or than Barack Obama lost in 2010. So that's a pretty impressive result, especially considering that Donald Trump is meant to be some sort of historically abnormal, you know, completely incompetent, completely shocking and extreme kind of president. In fact, voters seem to be pretty comfortable with him.
Are there any particular races, whether in the House or the Senate, that might be some kind of bellwether, or even if that's too over the top, nevertheless, were interesting races in that it made sense that we should want to keep an eye on them and interesting in how they turned out?
Yeah, I mean, there were a number of interesting races. I think one thing that can encourage Trump supporters and Republicans right now is how well the party did in Florida and also in Ohio. But in Florida, you had two very tight races for Senate and for governor, both of which the Republicans prevailed in. And of course, Florida is a key battleground in presidential elections. So that really gives Donald Trump, I think, something he can rely on come the next election. And similarly, doing well in Ohio also is something that Republicans should never take for granted. But with that in their favor, they are feeling pretty comfortable. I think the elections in Pennsylvania and Michigan, which were two states that Donald Trump won in 2016 and that are going to be battlegrounds again in 2020, those elections went in favor for the Democrats this November. But I don't think that really tells us very much about what the 2020 race is going to look like. In Pennsylvania, the Republicans didn't really have an A-list candidate going up against Democrats for the Senate and the governorship. Lou Barletta, who was the Republican running against Bob Casey for the U.S. Senate from Pennsylvania, was someone who'd been a pretty solid Republican congressman, had a background as a mayor as well. But he really ran a very poor campaign for Senate, and he just didn't have the kind of energy that one would expect from someone who was running on a kind of Trumpian America First platform. So it seems to me that there are very local explanations for some of the Republican failures this year, whereas it seems to me there's a more of a cultural explanation for the success of the Republicans in Florida. I think that the state really is tilting in their direction. Having said that, Florida did just pass a constitutional amendment to re-enfranchise felons. So that may be a factor in 2020, that you'll have a different electorate in Florida than you have right now.
Right. Now, in Florida, we had a very close, well, a couple of close races for governor, first of all, and then also for Senate. And Rick Scott apparently prevailed there, the Republican. The thing is that I've heard it said that Rick Scott winning in Florida in the U.S. Senate, well, at the same time, you have a much clearer ally, Trump ally, in Dave Brat in Virginia, who lost in his House race. And does the addition of a Rick Scott make up for the loss of somebody as, you know, a known quantity like a Dave Brat?
Well, as far as Florida is concerned, I would say that the DeSantis race is perhaps the better analog to Donald Trump. So DeSantis was running as for governor in Florida, and he campaigned in a style that was a bit more like Donald Trump than what you would see from someone like Rick Scott. And the fact that DeSantis beat Gillum in the governor's race in Florida suggests that Trump has a good benchmark in terms of 2020. He can do at least as well as DeSantis did, and probably a lot better. And in fact, Trump came into Florida and campaigned very hard for DeSantis. So this really was a kind of proxy fight for 2020 and what we're going to see in the Sunshine State that year. As far as Dave Brat goes, I have to say, I'd heard before the election, in the weeks leading up to it, from several sources that were very friendly to Dave Brat, but who said that Dave Brat made exactly the same mistake that his predecessor, Eric Cantor, had made several years ago. Eric Cantor was, a kind of D.C.-focused K Street Republican. He neglected his district, and he got voted out. Now, Dave Brat is not a K Street Republican. As you said, he's actually a pretty good ally for President Trump. He's a pretty good ally for, the rather more serious kinds of libertarians in the House. But Dave Brat also, from what I heard, did not go home to his district enough. He didn't feel like he had settled into his district enough. He was much more of a kind of, in some ways, a philosopher politician, or perhaps a critic would say a D.C. politician. But he just drifted away from his district. And as a result, he lost. It's a much more combative and competitive district than any politician can take for granted.
You said something about demographics, and nobody is supposed to say that there are some groups that vote particular ways and other groups vote other ways, even though all you have to do is look at the numbers. It's like it's racist to point this out, even though everybody knows that's what happens. So in Florida, I was looking at some of the numbers about men versus women and Hispanics versus non-Hispanics. And Hispanics were much, much more likely to vote Democrat. And some people say, well, that's because they're scared off by the Republicans' anti-immigration rhetoric. But I don't think that's really true, because even very, very pro-immigration Republicans have struggled with the Hispanic voters. So given how close these races were, maybe it's just a matter of time as the numbers change before you will be able to get what you want in Florida. You will be able to get that governor who wants to raise taxes, who wants to bring all the bad New England policies that have hurt those states and bring them down to Florida and implement them there. You may get your wish eventually. So that's a factor.
Well, one of the things in particular that's influenced Florida is that you've had a wave of migration, internal American migration, in fact, coming from Puerto Rico, that as Puerto Rico not just has suffered from hurricanes, but also had, has had a financial crisis that's been going on for years now. You've had waves of economic refugees basically coming from Puerto Rico, which is an American territory, to Florida. And that's, sort of not only changed the sort of ethnic demographics, but it actually changes the class demographics as well. That introduces a, poorer, set of people who can be, sort of attracted by Democratic messages. The demographic question is something I think Republicans have to get their minds around, but it's also something that Democrats can't really just sort of lie back and think is going to always benefit them. You can look at a country as diverse as Brazil, for example, and what's just happened in the Brazilian election? Well, you've had actually a very right-wing candidate, Bolsonaro, get elected. You can look at a country like India, which is one of the most, diverse countries on the planet in terms of its, sort of ethnic splits, in terms of its religious divisions, in terms of all sorts of things. And India, too, has a very, sort of nationalist government. Multiculturalism isn't always going to play in the Democrats' favor, I think, and they're going to be surprised by that. And you saw a little bit of this, I think, during the Kavanaugh hearings and the Kavanaugh sort of protests as he was about to be confirmed to the Supreme Court. that really you had a lot of white liberals who got very interested in this Kavanaugh brouhaha and who went out and protested. But even in Washington, D.C., which is a majority black city and a majority Democratic city by an even larger margin, you didn't see a lot of non-white Democrats come out and start protesting the Kavanaugh hearing. So Republicans do have a problem. The demographics are something that should worry them. But I think Democrats also have a problem that they haven't really grappled with. And that if you can find a way, for example, to make economic nationalism appealing to non-whites, you could have a really big realignment happen, kind of like how Donald Trump was able to go after industrial voters in the Midwest in 2016. These were voters that, you know, Republicans had written off since Ronald Reagan. But in fact, when they heard the right message, they turned very quickly.
The other demographic issue to talk about is age. Now, one reason that Republicans have been able to get away with not really connecting as well with the young is that no matter how many get out the vote drives you have for the young, they just don't show up, at least not in the numbers that older folks do. So Republicans have been able to hold that off. But it seems like quite a significant, I haven't seen the numbers, but just culturally, it seems like there's a huge gap there. But on the other hand, maybe it's the case that as you get older and you see that the world is slightly more complicated than I want something, so let's pass a law to give it to me, that maybe it doesn't, the world doesn't work that way. Maybe you're more likely to become a Republican and then it kind of solves the problem. So now you become somebody who is older and therefore more likely to vote, and now you're more likely to be a Republican. Maybe the problem solves itself. I don't know. What do you think, if anything, the Republicans need to do with regard to the youth?
Yeah, I wish I had a magic bullet for that. You know, I mean, a part of it is not just youth by itself, but it's the indoctrination and the way our educational system is currently working. In fact, you'll see that one of the clearest distinguishing marks now between Trump supporters and Trump opponents, or between Republicans and Democrats, tends to be education. That if you look at people who only have a high school education, whether they're men or women, and even across different demographics sometimes, you'll find that they have a stronger tendency to vote for the Republicans, and especially a stronger tendency to vote for someone like Donald Trump. By contrast, the more educated you are, supposedly, if you have a college degree, if you have an advanced degree, those things are indicators that you're more likely to vote Democratic and more likely to support basically, you know, what Donald Trump would call probably globalism. So this is one of the major fault lines in our politics in the years to come here. It's unlikely that people are going to stop going to college. It's unlikely that the colleges are going to stop being ideologically left-wing centers of indoctrination as much as learning. So it's hard to see what will happen here, but I suspect reality tends to reassert itself. That's one of the things that the communists kind of learned to their chagrin, is that you can have these experiments against reality for some time. You can have a fake economy. You can have, you know, fake legitimacy in your elections and so forth. But ultimately, that falsehood, that sense of disconnection from reality comes crashing down. And I suspect what will happen is that even though you will see some gains for the left from some of this miseducation, in the long run, the education that real life itself provides is going to reassert itself and change things back.
Dan, just a quick sponsored message. I'm sure the two of us are the same in that we both have many, many more books we'd like to get to than we could ever possibly read. And for every one we finish, we've got four more in mind. Well, the way to handle this is with an amazing app called Blinkist. Blinkist is the only app that takes thousands of the best-selling nonfiction books and distills them down to their most important elements, so you can read or listen to them in under 15 minutes, all on your phone. So with Blinkist, you'll expand your knowledge and learn more in just 15 minutes than you can in almost any other way. Plus, you can listen anywhere. I like to listen to Blinkist while I'm out and about because I'm always driving my daughters someplace. The Blinkist library is massive, from timeless classics like Think and Grow Rich to current bestsellers like The Laws of Human Nature. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial. You can cancel at any time. Blinkist.com/woods. Well, Dan, as we're recording this, we're reading that Jeff Sessions submitted his resignation to Trump, and there's now an interim figure holding that office, and then they'll appoint somebody else. What do you think it is exactly? And I suppose you probably don't need a crystal ball here, but what is Trump looking for in an attorney general? I don't understand, when it comes to Sessions, what he thought he was going to get with Sessions. I think Sessions pretty much did what I would have predicted Sessions would do. So what does Trump want here?
Well, I agree with you there. I think that Donald Trump is simply frustrated that a fabricated investigation of, you know, imaginary Russia connections based on opposition research, right, that was commissioned by the Democrats for the 2016 election, and where they got this, you know, sort of mercenary ex-spy to come up with these very dubious stories about Trump connections to Russia and, you know, things involving hookers and, you know, hotels in Moscow and so forth. I think Donald Trump is just so angry about all of that that he really wants, you know, his Justice Department to be able to make that whole thing go away. And unfortunately, I mean, just the way the system works, you can't snap your fingers and just banish this stuff. And if you do, you know, act the way that Donald Trump would like, you know, an attorney general like, you know, Jeff Sessions to have acted, chances are it actually only makes the problem worse. And in fact, you know, I think it was a mistake for Donald Trump to fire Comey when he did. Comey, the head of the FBI, should have been fired right away, you know, right from the beginning of the administration. But by firing him in what seemed to be a context involving the Russia investigation, Donald Trump kind of made it easy for his opponents to go out there and start, you know, an independent investigatory campaign with Robert Mueller. So I don't know that there's any attorney general who can live up to the expectations that Donald Trump might have for putting an end to this investigation. And in some ways, you know, as bad as the investigation might be, as much of a nuisance and distraction as it might be, fighting against it so hard is actually going to make things kind of worse. So I think that, you know, this is an area where Donald Trump needs a bit more patience than he's so far been willing to exhibit.
It seems like every presidential election cycle, we start getting into politics a little bit earlier and earlier each time. When in 2019 can we expect to see Democrats starting to announce their campaigns?
They'll start unofficially campaigning, as they have been already to some degree, to a much greater extent, basically right now. And, you know, already you're seeing a little bit of Beto O'Rourke buzz coming out of his defeat in Texas. I think that is significant, by the way. O'Rourke, even though he was beaten by Ted Cruz, he actually came pretty close. And while I think he's not a very plausible candidate for 2020, I can see why the buzz has developed and why it seems like if someone like him can do fairly well in Texas, then in other, you know, sort of states that are less Republican than Texas is, you would think that someone like O'Rourke might actually be a very, you know, sort of powerful contender. Now, for a variety of reasons, I think O'Rourke is inexperienced. I think he's a little bit flaky. All those things are going to cut against him. And I think he'll also have trouble with the left wing of the Democratic Party. But certainly he is someone who's very ambitious, and he has a fan club that's going to be eager to promote him.
There's a lot of chatter about candidates will be, and it sounds like it's going to be like the last Republican go-round where you had 16 candidates or whatever it was, because there are so many who could potentially throw their hats into the ring. I did read an article recently where some former top people for Bernie Sanders are kind of looking around to other places, thinking that maybe it's time for him to hand down, you know, to bequeath his legacy to somebody and not himself do it, but it's quite possible that he could. There have been rumors about Hillary, and then other people indignantly deny these. Joe Biden is more plausible, as is Michael Bloomberg, given some noise we've heard from him, and given how much money he has, he could stay in that election as long as he likes. Which ones of these names do you think, I mean, I know you mentioned O'Rourke, but what do you think are the ones who will have the staying power, and secondly, that would be the biggest threat to Trump?
Well, I think most of the people you've named are not very serious prospects this time. I think Hillary Clinton had her shot and she blew it. I don't see the Democrats deciding they want to lose with her again.
Right. Me either. That's why I just cannot get over all these articles where they're trying to pick up on a hint here and there in something she said. I just can't believe – I feel like there would be a revolt among some Democrats. I mean, of course, they hate Trump, so they would probably vote for anybody. But still, short of in the primary season, I feel like there'd be a revolt.
Oh, there absolutely would be. And, you know, if she were somehow to win the Democratic nomination, I don't think the Democrats could reasonably expect her to be able to beat Donald Trump. I think it would be it's just a very unlikely scenario, as is, you know, sort of the idea of resuscitating the political career of John Kerry, which a few people have suggested. That's also not going to happen. I think Michael Bloomberg is someone who always likes to talk about the idea of running for president. I don't think he could get the Democratic nomination. I don't think they would consider him left-wing enough. And if he ran as an independent, he would actually siphon votes away from the Democratic candidate and make it even more likely that Donald Trump would win. So if he runs, that may actually be a great benefit to Trump. As far as which Democrats do have a pretty good shot at getting their nomination, I think there are really, you know, sort of two or three categories. In one category, you have people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who are perceived as being economically left-wing, but who may not excite the sort of the minority elements of the Democratic political coalition. They don't have the identity politics appeal of someone like Barack Obama had in 2008. Now, if you put together identity politics plus left-wing economics, I think you actually have a candidate that the Democrats would be very excited about and very eager to have. But there's no one who combines those two worlds. So it seems to me that, you know, between Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, Sanders is probably the one with the more intense, you know, sort of real support within the Democratic Party. I think Warren is a candidate that, you know, is often talked up as, you know, someone who should be a plausible Democrat, but really isn't. I think that, you know, there are some Democrats, some people on the left who would look skeptically at her foreign policy, for example, who would even look skeptically at some of her economic policies. You know, she's a former Harvard professor. She lied about her ethnic background. I think she's just a kind of a silly candidate.
Yeah, and in fact, can I just jump in here for a second? Because I think if the conventional wisdom about this really is true, that that whole question of her ancestry really did blow up in her face. The media tried to cover for her for the first 24 hours or so. You saw all these favorable headlines. And then all of a sudden they realized, nope, this boat is too leaky even for us. So they really started to say, boy, this was a big mistake. And the key thing, if I were a Democratic strategist, the key thing for me is that it showed that going toe-to-toe with Trump, she is just made to look like a fool. And if this were to go on month after month after month, he makes her look like a fool, this is not going to end well.
That's exactly right. And if you think about this midterm election, you know, the Democrats took the House. The Democrats can point to, you know, pretty good numbers in terms of the, you know, meaningless but symbolic popular vote for the Senate and for the House. And they can look at these things and say, okay, this means that we're going to be in pretty good shape for 2020. But the thing is, in a midterm election for Congress and for state level offices, it's very easy to run against a president in the abstract. And that's one reason why I think we see a kind of tide instead of a wave of the House changing hands under each of the last four presidents. It's very easy to run against a president who's identified with a particular ideological viewpoint in the abstract. It gets a lot harder when you have to actually run against that person concretely, and you have to field a candidate of your own with real human weaknesses and real ideological weaknesses as well in competition against the president that you were able to successfully campaign against in congressional elections. So, Elizabeth Warren is clearly not someone who's cut out for battle with Donald Trump. I think Bernie Sanders actually, in a weird way, might be. Sanders, like Ron Paul, is, sort of so focused. He knows his own, school of thought. He knows his own philosophy so strongly, and he's so dedicated to it that I think he would actually be able to, you know, sort of have the thick skin necessary to take on Donald Trump. So I think Sanders, if he could somehow get the Democratic nomination, which I think is unlikely because moderates and some of the identity politics people will be against him. But if he could actually get the nomination, I think he'd be a surprisingly formidable candidate in November. Now, on the other side of the Democratic Party, you have people who seem like they ought to be, sort of exciting for purposes of identity politics. You have Kamala Harris, for example, and you have Cory Booker from New Jersey. But both of them, I think, have liabilities when it comes to the economic left, because both of them are seen as being very pro-corporate, pro-business, sort of pro-Wall Street Democrats. And I also think that, you know, a guy from New Jersey, a woman from California, they might have some difficulty appealing to Michigan. They might have some difficulty appealing to the swing states that are going to matter in 2020. So it seems to me that wing of the party, just like the economically left-wing side of the party, has some intrinsic problems that are going to be very difficult to overcome in 2020.
Let me ask you one more thing about Trump's temperament here, because that's something that's also been raised in some analyses of the midterms, because they say the midterms are a referendum on Trump and his first 2 years, but you can't separate Trump and his accomplishments from Trump and who, you know, and Trump's identity and who he is and his personality and his Twitter account and all that. And there are a lot of people out there who might be able to be talked into some of his policies on paper. If they were enacted by Mitt Romney or something, they would be more or less willing to go along with them. But some of these folks are professionals, and they feel like in professional circles they can't get away with saying, I support Donald Trump, because people will say, what are you, some kind of a, you know, I mean, you have no manners. They just feel like there's so much baggage because of his temperament. it does turn some people off. But at the same time, as soon as you start talking that way, you're reminded that that temperament brought him into the White House. So I get that. I'm not saying he's got to shut down his Twitter account. I do think that that had a good deal to do with why he won. But if he wants to build on that, I don't know. I mean, does he tone it down a bit? He definitely rallies his base, but I mean, what are your thoughts about that?
No, I don't think he'll tone it down. I did think, you know, after he won in 2016 that he might then have sort of changed the way he speaks, and that he might have, you know, tried to unify the country a little bit, and that he would have been in a position to do so because, you know, his Republican opponents had been crushed, and the Democrats, you know, would have been totally wrong-footed by Donald Trump, who suddenly sounded conciliatory and suddenly sounded, you know, a bit more like a kind of Ronald Reagan optimist instead of almost Pat Buchanan style, you know, sort of populist with a pitchfork. And Trump didn't do that. And I'm not entirely sure that Trump was incorrect, with the stance he took. I think he was right to see, and in fact has proved to be even more correct over time, that there were, you know, sort of, you know, what we call the deep state. There were elements, you know, of kind of elite media opinion that were so fundamentally opposed to President Trump that he had to be willing to, you know, sort of attack them head on, or else he just would have been steamrolled. But you're right. I mean, it is a there's, you know, an advantage to him in being as combative as he is, but there's also a disadvantage, and it's impossible to separate sort of the good part of that from the bad part. And so, you know, there's sort of a judgment call to be made, both on the part of voters and on the part of the president himself. Where does the sort of balance of virtue lie? Does it lie in, you know, being combative, even if that means that you're, you know, somewhat rude and the people are turned off by that? Or does it lie in, you know, being more civil, perhaps, but then also, you know, at the risk of not confronting, you know, really dedicated enemies the way that they really ought to be confronted?
Do you think, I know this is involves some prognostication here, but do you think the Democrats are going to move forward with anything like impeachment?
No, I don't. And in fact, I think the Democrats are kind of facing some difficulties here. First of all, I mean, obviously, impeachment would have very little chance of succeeding in convicting and removing President Trump because the Senate is in Republican hands. And even if, you know, the Democrats had, you know, somehow won the Senate by a very thin margin, remember, you actually have to have a supermajority in order to convict and remove a president. So certainly impeachment cannot succeed. Now, you know, the idea of trying to frame articles of impeachment and trying to start some sort of quixotic campaign to impeach Trump, well, you saw a little bit of, you know, sort of desultory Republican efforts to impeach Obama. You saw, you know, a lot of talk about it during the Clinton years, and none of that amounted to much. So you might see some discussion. You might see some congressional committees, you know, toying with the idea of impeachment. But it's all going to be for show. I mean, there's not going to be any real effort. Now, the Democrats, I think, even have a problem in terms of some of the congressional hearings they can hold to look into, for example, President Trump's tax returns, or looking into various aspects of the administration. Because I think the American people actually have a very limited patience for such sort of congressional tomfoolery. You saw that the whole Benghazi thing that Republicans whipped up against Hillary Clinton really didn't go very far. It was good for the Republican base. But nobody who voted against Hillary Clinton in 2016, it seems to me, did so simply because of the Benghazi hearings or things like that. It seems to me that if the Democrats hold, you know, incessant hearings into every minute, you know, business transaction or administrative, you know, sort of question that the Trump officials have handled, that the American people are going to get very sick very quickly of Congress's behavior. Finally, I should just note, remember, as controversial as Donald Trump might be, you know, his popularity ratings may be in the low 40s, but you can always, always count on one institution having far lower public approval ratings than the president, and that's Congress. Congress routinely has, you know, barely double digit or sometimes single digit approval ratings from most Americans. So it seems to me in a battle between a Democratic Congress and President Trump, it's the Democrats in Congress who are going to be the unpopular ones.
Dan, give us a quick – I always ask you to do this, but it couldn't hurt each time. Tell us something about Modern Age and how people can read it and anything interesting coming up there.
Well, I am delighted to say that the fall 2018 issue of Modern Age has just been published. It includes a long essay that I wrote on Samuel Huntington and the Clash of Civilizations, and it kind of looks at populism and nationalism and how those things relate to Huntington's thesis. So I think listeners of the podcast will find that very interesting indeed. We have other great material in the issue, including Peter Hitchens writing about the British philosopher John Gray's new book on seven types of atheism. And we just have a wealth of phenomenal material. You can subscribe to Modern Age by going to isi.org, which is the publisher of Modern Age. You can also look at Modern Age articles online and also find a way to subscribe at the URL modernagejournal.com.
All right. I'll link to that at tomwoods.com/1280. And I'll also link to your New York Times column. I'm going to have to get used to saying things like that, Dan. Just sound, doesn't seems foul in my mouth to say things like that. But I'll definitely link to it because people should take a look at what you're writing. And I always find it interesting. And when you sent that column out to a select group of friends, as soon as I saw the subject line, I thought we're getting Dan on the show. So I appreciate it.
Excellent. Well, I really appreciate that. Well, and the link is helpful too. I think, you know, I've never inquired about my traffic numbers whenever I write there, but I'm sure that the more traffic it gets, the more helpful that is for future endeavors.
Right. So help Dan McCarthy by clicking on that link. Okay. And then you can leave and go read some other publication. Thanks a lot, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, folks. How about this? Hugo Hornshaw is a 14-year-old homeschooler and competition rock climber, and he's got a website that he got the hosting for through my link. So here's his deal. He's currently ranked number one for his age category in his state of New South Wales, Australia, and is hoping to compete for his country next year. Hugo has started a website and a YouTube channel with regular video tutorials on climbing, training for climbing, product reviews, and even some health and nutrition advice. So the website is hugoclimbing.com, and it's very impressive. From there, you also click through to his YouTube channel. So Hugo is asking if you could please help out by subscribing to the channel on YouTube, because now, in order to monetize a YouTube channel, YouTube requires 1,000 subscribers. So if you could help out Hugo, a 14-year-old homeschooler who's a competition rock climber, he would certainly appreciate it. So get there by visiting hugoclimbing.com. See how I help out my listeners? All you got to do is get your hosting through my link. I'll give you a nice publicity like this, plus membership in my bloggers group, some free tutorials to get you started, and a backlink on my site, which will give you some nice SEO juice. How do you get those things? Check out tomwoods.com/publicity for the details. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.